time to catch the beat for Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign. And Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. Catch the Beat is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Jane Addams Bookshop in downtown Champaign. For more than 40 years, Jane Addams Bookshop has been a destination for readers and book lovers of all ages. Featuring three floors of gently used books, greeting cards, journals, and more. Jane Addams Bookshop is at 208 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Online at Jane Addams, that's A-D-D-A-M-S, books.com. As always on WEFT, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I'm your host, Coke Cumston. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Maureen Warren, Krannert Museum Curator of European and American Art. I knew I would love a conversation with you after your gallery tour of the current exhibit at Krannert Art Museum on view until February 28th, Imagination, Faith, and Desire. It's a notable collection of over 100 early modern European prints, engravings, etchings, and wood prints featuring many luminaries, including Rembrandt and Dürer. Maureen, you came to Krannert with impressive experience and scholarship around prints and drawings, focusing on those from the 1500s to the 1800s. Tell us a bit about what it is you study and what brought you to Krannert.
Great. Thanks for having me, Cope. I was brought to Krannert after working at the Art Institute of Chicago for a year in the prints and drawings department. There I worked on an exhibition that Victoria Sancho Lobos curated on that was called Rembrandt and the Portrait Print, Rembrandt Van Dyke and the Portrait Print. And so I've had other museum experiences that focused in this area. But even prior to that, my dissertation research at Northwestern was centered on Dutch political cartoons, basically the early predecessors of the political cartoons we see in newspapers today. So artists criticizing political figures or battles or alliances or other sort of government and decisions and politicians in the visual realm and in published and printed images. And I was really drawn to CAM with the idea that I could work on not only my own area of expertise, but a lot of other topics with it being an encyclopedic collection. And that was really appealing to me to work in my area of specialty and then beyond it.
So the Krannert has a particularly strong collection of prints and engravings?
It is a strong and growing collection. Funnily enough, this institution is a little peculiar in that the collection of paintings has traditionally been quite a bit stronger than works on paper, owing to the fact that some of the earliest donors of art to the museum, Merle and Emily Trees, who started giving works of art in the 30s and 40s, long before we established a museum in the 60s, they gave paintings from the 1500s into the contemporary time for them and ended up giving about 40 major paintings. So it's a little bit of an unusual situation in which the painting collection here has historically been the largest, and prints is something that has existed, but we've been growing.
This particular exhibit, Imagination, Faith, and Desire, you indicated when you spoke with us at the museum that this is a very special gathering of a very unusual, high-quality prints, many from a private collection. Tell us a little bit about how this exhibit came to be and what makes it so unusual.
The exhibition brings together several private collections. So it's all private collections, a loan show. And these are the kind of works that, while not super common, still surfaced on the market more commonly 40, 50, 60 years ago. These are the type of works that are so special, so rare, and not just any impression, but early, very strong, crisp impressions. Prints, especially intaglio prints on copper. The batch at the front of the run is more crisp, more detail, more subtle lines, and over time the extreme pressure of the press flattens out the copper plates such that you lose nuance and detail, the lightest lines fade. These are all very early strong impressions. But this is a type of print that does not surface so often anymore on the market and has become really prohibitively expensive for private individuals on the most part. There still are a handful of very wealthy collectors, but we're really kind of seeing the end of a collecting era in these particular private collections, where one could amass a show at this scale that has the kind of works that typically you'd only find in these numbers at the most prestigious blue chip civic institutions in the country. So it was a chance to bring together works at a smaller institution, the likes of which we probably wouldn't be successful in trying to get the loans from the institutions that do have impressions of this quality because of the need to protect them from light exposure.
And you had particular ideas about what you wanted this exhibit to be. You said that you were able to select the pieces that you wanted for this particular show. What were your thoughts as you were planning this? And also, when did you start planning it?
This happened on a really accelerated timeline. Generally, this is slated for our East Gallery, which is a 5,000 square foot gallery. And so generally, for shows of that scale, we plan 3 years in advance to have time to fundraise and prepare. And I think a lot of people don't realize a lot of times museums are expected to be creating their timelines for art shipping at least 1 year in advance to just have artwork moved. So you have to be preparing well in advance. But this particular show, due to the constraints of some of the collectors, needed to happen in about a year and a half. So it was really an accelerated rate. But because I knew the whole breadth of the collection, I was able to sort of see all the pieces out on the board, if you will, and kind of assemble the thematic groupings that I wanted to have in the exhibition out of those holdings. So that sped up the process because it wasn't sort of curating with a list of anything possible one might borrow from anywhere, but out of a set number of collections with specific items. And in terms of my objectives, I wanted to demonstrate to a broad audience that printed images were as impactful as the printed text. Usually when people speak about the printing revolution in Western culture, they think only about movable type. And I wanted to show how integral printed images were to people's ideas at the time.
The themes that you organized in this are very interesting. And as we moved through the show and the galleries, it was fascinating. One entire section on images of Adam and Eve, and all of a sudden it was evident how different these different artists conceived of the story of Adam and Eve and who they were as characters. So the six sections, No Mere Artisan, Artistic Imagination, Itinerant Aesthetics, Inhabited World, Eliciting Desire, and I'm missing one here. I didn't find it.
Channeling Faith.
Thank you. You would know it. You have all this right at the top of your head. Talk about how you planned these themes.
When I was thinking about the themes, I was recalling back to my days as an undergraduate. And when I started off as an art student, but I switched to art history because I was so compelled by how important artwork was in the lives of specifically Europeans in the Renaissance and Baroque periods, but how it informed not only their faith, but how they considered their place in the world and their relationship to other people. It was never just art for art's sake, never just beautification or inspiring wonder. Not that there's anything wrong with art doing that, but this was really key to how people thought about themselves in the world. So, for example, one of the things that is a main thoroughfare in the discussion of the Renaissance is the transformation of the artist from an unnamed craftsperson to a named individual, someone like Leonardo or Michelangelo or Durer, whose biography and identity and eventually face and likeness is tied up in the value of what they produce. It's not just that they have great technical skill, but it's their imagination, their experience, their upbringing, the other people they're in contact with. This is really a fundamental shift in the way we think about art, and I think something that now is kind of taken for granted. And printed images were a major part of that. So three of the six themes actually relate to our notion of art and how printed images changed that. So one of those sections looks at how printed images before photography helped spread knowledge of compositions and objects made by other artists. Like I said, something that photography would later replace, and any sort of art history textbook shows the legacy of that. And the other two subsections relate to changing notions of individual artistic creativity, and then something that we might broadly consider branding, or the idea of individual artist fame and creativity. But all of those shifts could not have taken place without printed images that allowed people across different times and places to be discussing these individuals and the works they created. It was truly a medium of mass communication that shifted our understanding of art and that and disciplines related to art.
How did these prints come about? Looking at any one of them, it is an unbelievably intricate piece just to produce them. The quality of line and all of the script writing that had to be engraved on a copper plate backwards, and the lettering is exquisite. And so would an artist have the wherewithal to just take the time that it required to produce these things? And then how would they get out into the public? How would people know about them and purchase them? And how would people see them?
The tradition of printmaking in Europe stems from two closely interconnected fields, and that is goldsmithing or jewelry making, and then armorers, people that produced really, really high-end armor that would have elaborate engraved decoration. And so originally these were jewelers and blacksmiths wanting to preserve records of their design as their pieces went out to customers. And they started inking these curved metal surfaces and using paper to keep a kind of workshop notebook. And the earliest European prints are quite small. They're in general much smaller. They're rarely exceed the size of like an A7 sheet of paper, a standard sheet of copy paper. They're usually a little under that. And even the biggest early modern prints don't get a lot bigger, usually, than like 2 by 3 feet. That would be a very big sheet of copper, a very expensive kind of outlay for materials. So it's always been sort of precious in a way that comes out of this metalsmithing tradition. And as it becomes an independent medium in its own right, you get the rise of print publishers who operate very much like book publishers today. They're coordinating the labor of different aspects of production. So in this case, it could be an artist that is both designing and engraving a work that then they're printing and selling, or over time it becomes even more specialized where you have a print designer who produces a drawing, someone who either engraves the copper plate or cuts the wood block, and then the publisher that's running presses that ensure clean, even runs of impressions that they're then distributing to other publishers and selling, just like we would visit a bookshop to pick up a book now.
The prints that are more considered political content versus artistic, was there a different way of publishing those and they would go to different audiences?
It's a lot of the same audiences, because even though these are remarkably inexpensive, for instance, some of the very high-end political prints that were made by very talented artists, really high production quality, they still sold for about the equivalent of a pint of beer in a tavern. So we could think $5 or $10. Something like a very high-end, now we would call them art prints, by somebody like Rembrandt, that would be more akin to a couple $100. So the type of people who are literate and have that kind of disposable income are going to be a kind of moneyed middle class, merchant class. Some of them would be purchased by like taverns where they would be stuck up on the wall. So they decorate interior spaces. And they're also, because there are a lot of them that, I mean, if it's $5 or $10, it's not precious. It's like a nice magazine. They would get passed around in things like carriage rides, or in the Netherlands, you have regular barge departures that travel on canals. So you've got a group of strangers sitting and chatting, and we know from letters that they would pass them around and discuss them, and you would have someone who's literate reading it out for people who are illiterate. So they do have a pretty broad circulation, and they are part of a kind of regular life of discussion in a way that really isn't unlike an internet meme or a magazine or something now, where it's affordable enough and you want to share it and talk to your friends if you like it, especially. One of the prints, for example, Durer's Adam and Eve, is maybe no larger than 10 by 12 inches, maybe a little smaller than that. And we blew it up to over 100 times to where now the figures are life size. And it's still compelling and interesting at that huge scale because it's so many lines and so intricate and well made. And I think that just speaks to the expectation of folks at the time that this wasn't a purchase and look at it and throw it away. This was pre-lens arts, pre-cinema. People lived with images a lot longer and expected to look at them over the course of years and still find enjoyment and detail and interest after dozens and dozens of times looking at it.
What about the technical requirements of producing these, the actual engraving on copper, and then the very different process of cutting into wood blocks?
Woodblock is the earlier technology and the more durable. So woodblock emerges and it uses the same press as movable type. So you can set an image within the same sheet as type. And this is why you get a lot of books illustrated this way. It's much less expensive and more expedient. But you can also print thousands of copies off a woodblock without serious degradation of the image. They're carving on the end grain and it's a very tough surface. Whereas intaglio, copper plate, the estimates vary, but I'd say maybe up to 1,000, but you're going to start noticing some degradation after several hundred prints. You can always re-engrave and strengthen the lines, and that sometimes happens and sometimes doesn't. And with some artists like Rembrandt, the plates outlive him by quite a bit, and you end up with impressions where the matrix, the copper plate, has been reworked by other people. And so you get a kind of diminishing scale of his participation in the prints that are, eventually so reworked, they're really kind of somebody else's work being printed. A copper plate engraving it's not easy, but it's a lot more forgiving in terms of the type of curving lines and detail. A woodcut is like cutting a rubber stamp. You have to cut away the negative space, the white space, and if you accidentally cut into the line, you're going to see that chunk out of the line, whereas copper plate is the inverse, and the lines you're making are what print as black. You have printers like Rembrandt who become, and this becomes even more true throughout the 19th century, someone who is thought of as not just the person designing it, but prints all of their own prints and does not treat each impression the same. So maybe they sometimes leave a little more ink in the surface of the sky to suggest haze or, a kind of cloudy day. And you get what some people think of as a more painterly approach to printmaking, a more sort of, it's not about making sure every impression is exactly the same, the way you have under some of these earlier print publishers where they're striving for consistency. It's more about experimentation, and each impression can be a kind of new iteration of the thought. Rembrandt really stands out as someone who is quite famous for printing his own prints, but that also means there's a lot fewer of them. And under these professional print publishing houses, they're really about maximizing profits. So they want a run as large and consistent as possible. So they would have professional pressmen very expediently churning out high quality impressions. It's not an advantage for them to have the first and last look very different. They want consistency. They want someone who's seen something they like at their friend's house to be able to come in and get the exact same thing, whereas someone like Rembrandt is on the other end of it, where he not only doesn't want them all to look the same, but he realizes there's a market that he can sell the same print more than once to high-end collectors if they aren't the same. And he starts to explore states, which is any change in the print. So even something down as small to adding a button on the hat in a portrait, and the kind of specialist collectors get excited about that new variant and will start to collect. And we even get something a little bit later called a privilege that acts as a very early copyright, which is usually in the name of some type of sovereign. So the Holy Roman Emperor or the French King, some specific individual is named, and they grant a privilege of something like 5 or 10 years. And this means that it's funny, the early copyright doesn't state that you can't copy their design. You can copy their design, but you can't sign the artist's name to it. And this is actually a result of Albrecht Dürer suing somebody who copied a series of prints he did and put his monogram on them. And the courts determined that that is not legal because the brand and quality of that artist is diminished by inferior copies. If people think they're doing this shoddy work, they're not going to get more commissions. So they can't protect their composition that they've invented, but they can protect their name or monogram.
This exhibit is going to be up for quite a bit longer, which is wonderful. I think February 28th. Now, what would you say to someone just coming in who doesn't know much at all about this? How would you advise that people approach looking at this exhibit?
I think people know what they intrinsically like, and I think it's always a good idea to start with something that is visually appealing to you. Start from the basis of something you find attractive, and then as you learn more about it, it becomes that much more interesting and delightful to experience. So I would say come into any of the galleries and give a kind of quick perusal to everything on the wall. And zero in on something that you think is especially beautiful or surprising or interesting. And then once you go up to that, there will be more often than not an extended label to direct you to one or two details. But then also, each gallery is part of one of the six sub-themes, and there is a relatively short text that's in a much bigger font on one of the walls that explains, you know, is this a scene of daily life? Is this a scene about gender and sexuality or artistic imagination? And between reading that main overview text and then the little text next to it, your attention will be drawn to one specific aspect. But then it's really just a matter of sitting with it. I think sometimes, especially if you're not accustomed to being in museums, if you don't instantly have a reaction, sometimes it's like, well, this isn't for me. I would say just give it 30 to 60 seconds. Just live with it a little bit, and you'll discover new details, and it sort of opens itself up to you. I think all of us with social media have sort of shortened attention spans, and this is a kind of experience where 30 seconds might feel like a long time, but it really will bloom like a flower. If you sit there and spend a little time, you'll take a lot more detail in, and it will become a much richer experience.
Can you give us a preview of other projects you're working on now that we may be looking forward to seeing at the museum?
Absolutely. I've got a project that I'm really excited about that's slated for fall of 2026 that will be about contemporary Taiwanese art that engages with the tradition of ink arts. So monochromatic black ink painting, Sumie ink painting, and calligraphy. And that show is really beautiful. It's very little of it is actually ink. It's a lot of digital art and sculpture. A lot of it's centered around landscapes and floral still life, but engaging with issues of technological advancement and colonization and empire. It's artwork that, again, at first glance, it's very beautiful and visually compelling. And then the more you learn about this millennia deep tradition, and whether it's ideas coming out of Buddhism or Neo-Confucianism or these other sort of rich traditions, as you learn more, it's just that much more engaging and interesting. But even at first blush, they're very beautiful and impressive works of art. And with that, I'm collaborating with a curator and a design firm out of Taiwan. I was so lucky to work with Shozo Sato when he was still living. And I, when I was in graduate school, I did my minor in my art history program on Qing Dynasty Chinese art. So I had some familiarity with East Asian, especially traditional, sort of 16th, 17th, 18th century art. And when I saw his Sumi-Ye ink paintings that he made predominantly in the second half of the 20th century, I could see how he was very thoughtfully engaging with the historical tradition, but to speak to issues of, his identity as a Japanese American in the US and his experience and notions of the West and cinema and his youth in Osaka and time in Illinois and California. So I had just enough familiarity with ink painting to be able to realize how spectacular these Taiwanese art is and how they're doing something similar, but with film and video installation and animation and sculpture. And I was asked to partner with Yusha Chang, who's the associate director for the Center for East Asian and Pacific Studies. And so we're working side by side with these partners in Taiwan to create programming and the exhibition around it. But it really stemmed from that little bit of familiarity, having worked with Shozo Sato. And so I've been very fortunate to have just enough to be able to advocate to take this project.
I got to study brush lettering with Shozo and knew him for a long time, but long before the current Japan House was built. And he was such an amazing man. And I was really pleased to see that you had curated his exhibit.
I was really grateful to do it. I was really happy that it worked out and John Seidel supported it because we had to do that fast. We put that together in a year because he was already not very well when I started working. I'm so grateful he got to see it. Yeah, that was really very fortunate.
I want to thank you so much for your time and your encyclopedic knowledge. Boy, you know your stuff. It's really fascinating to hear the layers and layers behind these works of art. So thank you, Maureen. And I truly encourage people to spend time at the exhibit.
That wraps up our time for this week's Catch the Beat. I give a big thanks to Dr. Maureen Warren, Curator of European and American Art at the Krannert Art Museum, for an inside view of the world of prints in imagination, faith, and design on view at the Krannert Art Museum until February 28th, 2026.
Catch the Beat is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Jane Addams Bookshop in downtown Champaign. For more than 40 years, Jane Addams Bookshop has been a destination for readers and book lovers of all ages, featuring three floors of gently used books, greeting cards, journals, and more. Jane Addams Bookshop at 208 North Neal in downtown Champaign, online at janeadamsbooks.com. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming on weft.org. All episodes of Catch the Beat are archived on the WEFT website at weft.org under Public Affairs. You can also listen to live stream and archive shows on the WEFT app, available on your favorite app store. With thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.
Hey, this is Ani DeFranco, and you're listening to W.